Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Chad from grayscalegorilla.com. Welcome to another episode of the Grayscale Gorilla podcast. I think we're on episode, is this 49, guys?
Holy moly.
I think
what are we going to do for 50?
I have no idea.
Oh, but, no.
So we're at 49, and we're trying something a little bit different this time. So you might notice the format is a little bit different than you're used to, and that's to try to streamline this entire process so that we can get you the podcast quicker. So as I said before, welcome to our podcast. We've got, as always, our good friends, Chris Schmidt, say hello.
Hello, hello.
And Mr. Nick Campbell.
Hello, hello. Sorry if my voice is a little funky today. I basically lost my voice the last couple of days, so it's slowly coming back.
Nice. Actually, this format, you look really crisp and clear, I gotta say. And it even says like HD in the corner when your face pops up.
Nice and refreshed. Because for those of you on audio, you know, you got to check out apparently I'm looking real good today. Thank you, Chad. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no worries. So you'll notice in this format, it's the YouTube kind of Hangouts format. So it's going to do some live editing. So we're going to try to work on our ability to not make it flip between each other too much and make you all sick. But if you're listening to us through iTunes or some other podcast, you won't have that problem. All right. So let's get the show started. Nick, what do we got in GSG news?
GSG news, what's happening this week? We still got t-shirts for sale. One more week from today, so it might not even be before the next podcast comes out. If you guys are looking for a new Grayscale Gorilla t-shirt, for those of you who have the last one from a few years ago, we have some pretty cool ones up on a site called Cotton Bureau, and we'll make sure we put the link here in iTunes on our page somewhere. Where will that be? On the blog. So head on over to the blog, look for episode 49. You'll find a link there, or you could get them on YouTube. We'll link it up down below. But basically, man, if you're looking for something real good, you know, to wear around that lets other nerds know you watch some Grayscale Gorilla and confuses the rest of everybody else, this is the shirt for you. It's actually just for those of you who do care, because I certainly do care. It's a really well-made shirt. It's looking good. I actually just wore the other Cotton Bureau shirt I made yesterday, and it's plenty soft and comfy and everybody. So if that's interesting, check that out. What else is going on? We got a new tutorial coming up, and the podcast, as always, every week.
Whose tutorial is it?
It is my tutorial this week.
What's it going to be about?
Whoa.
I am going to talk about the take system. I think somebody hit me up on, I forget what it was. It might have been Instagram or something, but they wanted to know all about, or they had a question about takes and when or whether or not they should use them. They were kind of confused as to what they did and how they might save them time. So I'm going to
I know I know the spoiler for that, and that's Chad's answer is going to be always.
Exactly. Always. Yeah, gee, why else would I be doing it, right? I'm going to do a whole thing on takes and why I think they're awesome. Coming from other programs that have similar systems, from Maya, you have like their override system, and in Max, you had, I think they might have called them, it's been so long, I forgot the name of what they called them. But anyway, talk about takes and how they can help you save time.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you guys too, I was at an event this weekend called Ord Camp, and it's always kind of difficult to explain, but it's basically, it's at the Google headquarters in Chicago, but it's run by a bunch of smart people in Chicago, basically. And they invite people from around the country to come and share their stories about technology and about being creative. And it's this really interesting weekend. I won't get into all the crazy stuff that happened, but two things I wanted to share with you guys. One is somebody from Pixar stopped me and said, you're the Grayscale Gorilla, right? I'm like, how do you watch us? Like, what's going on? How did you know? And he goes, well, I work for Pixar. I'm like, keep going. And he goes, we all kind of started in our spare time, you know, in between working on, you know, sometimes they say like they're working on the same shot over and over again sometimes. And they all decided to give each other like a challenge to go make something in their free time, kind of like a daily render challenge. So as they pushed each other to go make and do those things, they discovered Beeple, and they fell in love with Beeple. And Beeple graciously put our website on his site to say, hey, you're looking to learn this kind of stuff. Go check out Grayscale Gorilla. And then our faces popped up. So that was really cool. Somebody or a small group at Pixar, at least, are watching some Grayscale Gorilla in their spare time to learn some cinema and mess around with this. So that was cool.
You can't top that.
Can't top that. That was really fun to hear. Just always like, you know, seeing how people find out about us as well. And then also there was a thing about how to solve a Rubik's Cube. So I'm really, really excited to work on that this week. There's basically four main steps. I got the two first ones kind of good without having to read it. But the second two start to get more complicated. So
that didn't look like a real Rubik's Cube. Was that like a newer one or something?
For those of you on the visuals, you could see that this is a stickerless. So this is what I learned. This is a stickerless Rubik's Cube, which is important for a couple reasons. One is it's just more robust. You could spin around without the little stickers coming off. And apparently Rubik's themselves, like the company or the actual branded Rubik's Cube, has like the what you would imagine as a Rubik's Cube with like the black plastic with the stickers on it. As people started wanting to solve these things faster and faster and faster, companies like this came out. And this is some Chinese company, I forget the name of it. I will put it in the show notes. It says Play Cube Puzzle Timer. So these are speed cubes, which means see all the rounded edges?
Yeah.
This means that you could like move much faster. So if you do like, what was it? Boom, 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 boom. And like practicing that over and over again and being able to do that quickly, it allows you to do that without it having to be exactly lined up. It could be a little bit off like that, but then it still spins. Where the Rubik's Cube itself is like so, is more rigid and you can't do those fast moves. So
these are like training wheels.
Yeah, a little bit training wheels, but these are also the ones they use, and not this exact one, but this style of ones are the ones they use when they do the speed runs as well. So anyway, this was really fun little talk and figured that out. But yeah, that was it. That was my weekend, and that's partly why my voice is a little messed up. We've been talking all weekend.
The colors on that thing are actually really cool,
aren't they? And they're way cooler colors, aren't they?
Yeah, kind of want one just to like set it on my desk. I would never solve it in a million years, but
well, what else is going on this week before we get into today's topics?
Let's see, what else do we got going on? We have a very important anniversary coming up this week, which I believe is Thursday. Let's see.
Yep, Thursday.
And that important date is, Nick, why don't you tell us what that date is? It's an important date for you and the company, but it really started with you.
Yeah, Thursday. And let me expand it. What's the actual date? 2008?
Yep.
So February 2nd, 2008 was when I started the Grayscale Gorilla blog, which until then, Grayscale Gorilla was just a photography site where I posted a photo a day and just went out, took photos. Digital photography was kind of becoming a bigger thing in 2003-04 when I started the site. By the time 2008 rolled around, everybody started grabbing these digital cameras and was interested in how I did all this stuff, how I imported my photos and how I did cropping and color correction and Photoshop and organizing my favorite takes and all that kind of stuff. So as the questions started rolling in and as Twitter started becoming bigger and I was getting questions, I had no real place to put all these answers. And the blog was where I figured I would do that. I would start the grayscalegorilla.com/blog. And that would be where I could put links to some of my favorite, you know, photography and other, you know, design things, music, and also talk a little bit about how I do my work day to day. Well, word got out. I also knew After Effects. And so I started doing some After Effects tutorials. And then word got out that I was experimenting with Cinema 4D, and there was like almost no Cinema 4D video tutorials on the web, you know, on the web at the time. And that's kind of how Grayscale Gorilla, as it is today, was kind of accidentally born in a way, was just experimenting with the blog and experimenting with teaching people anything that I knew. And that was the whole idea of the site to begin with, was I know this stuff. I learned it from watching other people and by experimenting all day long. And I'm just going to share with you guys stuff that I know. So started doing Photoshop, After Effects, and Cinema 4D tutorials. Obviously, the Cinema 4D tutorials really took off, mostly because I think for two reasons. There weren't a lot of, wasn't a lot of content at the time, but also I did full projects, which wasn't really a thing online very much, like going through an entire process. But the third thing is I wasn't some expert guru explaining from on high how to do Cinema 4D. I was just somebody like, at the time, like everyone else, like just trying to figure this stuff out. So I think the language was there. So I put that date in the calendar just to remind us like where all this stuff started, but also understand that that was, what is it? 9 years ago?
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. So over 9 years ago. And so that was 2008. By 2009, I left my full-time job to pursue this, project full-time. And so that was September in 2009. So that's how long it took to go from experimenting, playing with a blog and experimenting with online video to then going in full-time, building Lightkit Pro, doing all that stuff. So anyway, I like thinking about those dates. We don't really have an official Grayscale Gorilla birthday. You know, it could be September when I left, it could be there, but I thought the blog might have been like a pretty good day to celebrate around here. So thanks for letting me share my story. And of course now, man, how many places are there now to go learn Cima and play? And
a lot. Definitely a lot.
Here's just one more thing to think about. When I started doing these videos, there was a big debate between Vimeo and YouTube, mostly because YouTube didn't even do HD video yet. Right? So that's how long ago this was. There was like almost no million viewed YouTube videos back then, like 2008, right?
Yeah, I feel like it was easier to, I guess you always just kind of knew Vimeo was the place where you were going to find that stuff. And then like over time, things started to get more and more scattered. And now that we're on YouTube, I don't think I ever go to Vimeo ever, unless somebody's like got a link that's, you know, embedded. But
I think they're doing a really good job in like curating artwork and really short films and that kind of stuff. I think they're doing a good job. They almost kind of did like a Netflix pivot as well, where they do paid content. You could do subscription stuff, things like that. So interesting stuff over there. I just think for us too, to get in front of people is really what we want. We want to help as many people as we want. When they search for how to use Cinema 4D, we want to be there. So yeah, YouTube's been, maybe that's a different discussion, but YouTube's been fun this year to learn and experiment with. But yeah, that was, oh man, 9 years ago. And Chris, Chris had a fun idea about like maybe talking about one of our favorite tutorials from back in the day of like maybe something that not everybody has seen already.
Mm. Okay, yeah. What's your favorite?
Who's that?
Whoever. Somebody go.
Well, I'll do one. I mean, first of all, it's hard to pick. There are a lot of them. But one that I just kind of like overall, the idea kind of struck and then we executed on it and created it very quickly is the microphone tutorial. It's another favorite because it's one of those two-parters. So in the microphone tutorial, I actually model a microphone from scratch, but you know, you get that really nice, I mean, heck, you can see it on the screen right here. When you look at the microphone up close, it's got this really awesome wire mesh that's all kind of weaving in and out. So it's physically modeled in that tutorial. And the extra thing I like about it is we build it flat. And then just like I imagine in real life, they have a big piece of metal and then they go and they squish it in a mold to bend it into a spherical shape. And then they do it in two parts and you can actually see the bends in the tutorial, just like you would get in real life. And then Nick takes over, textures it up and lights it. And it's just a great little two-part tutorial with a technique that I think is applicable to a lot of different things.
So when you made that tutorial, did you go and like research how the microphones were actually constructed before you started figuring out how to approach it in 3D?
No, it started out with just like trying to weave, you know, build some weaves in 3D And then like, okay, how do I shape this? And then it started turning into like, I want to make a particular shape. And then I think me and Nick brainstormed a little bit and we were like, well, we should make a microphone. And I was like, well, how the heck do I make this? And I'm looking at the microphone and I was getting frustrated because when I would deform the mesh in 3D, it was really distorting the way the wires looked and they weren't straight anymore. And I looked at real microphones and it was the exact same way. I was like, oh, that makes perfect sense. So I kind of accidentally recreated the real process you would do. And I was aiming for a perfection that wasn't real. It was like a theoretical perfection. So that was fun. So I'll put the link for that in the notes.
Yeah, that's a good one. I almost forgot about that one. And I like that one too, because it kind of shows like if I had to approach that problem of trying to create that mesh over that, like, you know, spherical shape, I wouldn't have thought to have done it that way, I don't think. And that's interesting. And sometimes, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you did it that way and then later you found out that it was actually, that's how they manufactured them in real life. Like that's pretty cool. Like usually that's an interesting idea, is to like start thinking about how do they manufacture something in real life and can that apply to your modeling process?
Yeah, I think that was when I went down the texture rabbit hole a few years ago or a couple years ago now with top coat and reflectance and learning like a real physical based render, when physical render came out, I realized that the more I learned about how they made real textures and real materials in real life, the more that would apply to when I made them in 3D. And I don't know why I had to relearn that lesson again. It's exactly the same lesson you were yelling at me about, Chad, in 2005 and 6 about lighting, which is, I knew all about photography and studio lighting and how to take photos of people and how flashes worked and how softboxes worked. And you just simply said, like, that one sentence, take what you know about photography and bring it into 3D and your renders will look more like good photography. And with materials in particular, it was learning that all these layers of reflectance actually are there because of how they make many materials. Some, you know, I talked to my buddy who makes guitars and he's like, okay, first we, you know, do the bass spray, like the flat coat. And then on top of that, we do the kind of like more glossy coat. That's not the final coat, but this is like the real substance of it. But it's also semi clear so that the base coat comes through. And then on top of that, we do this final polish and that's where we add all the sparkles and we add like all the glitter pieces. And I'm like, oh, you're literally layering stuff to make this look. There is no one can of paint you can go get to make it look like a guitar or a car or like many things. The same paint that you paint a drywall with can be used for wood, can be used for fabrics, and it all has a different look because of this layering. So that idea of modeling the way that real world is like another way I'm thinking of it. Like, wow, even if you take how the real world makes stuff, apply it to how you can model it, that's just an interesting way to think of it. And it seems like it's always more realistic with, not always. It seems oftentimes it's more simple and more realistic if you just approach it the way that it's made in real life.
No, I mean, it may not be as applicable in modeling because it's just, you know, we have so many ways that we can cheat that you just can't do that in the real world. But in terms of almost every other aspect of 3D, that's what I always preach to people is like, you know, just look at how it's made in real life and then just try to emulate that. Look at, start with the data that you have, you know, as a person walking through the world and then apply that in 3D and you're already like 60 or 70% there in terms of, you know, how do I create the best metal or whatever. And it's like, okay, we'll find out what kind of metal is it that you're trying to make? Oh, I'm trying to make iron. Okay, well, what's the index of refraction on iron? Well, it's this, this, and this, and it's complex IOR, and it looks like that. Okay, that's data you can just Google and find within like 5 seconds and plug that into your renderer. And already you've got something that's closer to the way iron's going to behave than anything that you could guess in your head and just fiddle with knobs. So starting with that base of like, well, how's it made in the real world? What's its physical properties in the real world? You can find this stuff out so easily now that it just becomes, okay, let me take that data and put it into physical render or Octane or Redshift or whatever. and then build from there. And you've got that foundation that's actually built in reality, and you didn't have to sit there and be like, well, you know, I think that plastic is a little bit more, has a little bit more index of refraction. No, you know, the if it's a specific kind of polyurethane plastic, you know, it's like a 1.45 or something, and plug that in and you're halfway there. Because a lot of it, you know, in terms of doing glass in particular, it's people often make that mistake where they think that they're going to get good glass based on the reflection or somehow in the diffuse, and there's really no diffuse in glass, and it's all about the index of refraction, tying that into the reflection. And there's just, if you just know some of these numbers, you don't even have to know what they mean. You just have to know where they go. If you plug them into the right place, you will get somewhere that's decent. And then as you go, you'll learn what they do. And even I couldn't tell you the scientific properties of light and the wavelengths in which they reflect. And I don't know, you know, like, I don't care to know. I just want to know, how do I get the most realistic looking, cool looking metal or plastic or glass or whatever, you know?
So Chad, do you have a favorite tutorial? Now you're a little You're a little new to Cinema 4D in the last couple of years, but
I got a good one.
You got one?
I got one, man. I've been waiting to tell this story. So I don't know when you did this tutorial. It was probably at least 3 years into GSG, and it's the most, probably one of the most popular tutorials. It's the 7-Up Cherry tutorial. And for those of you who haven't seen this tutorial, it's basically, there was a commercial out at the time that for 7-Up, Cherry 7-Up, that had all these cherries, and I think PSYOP did it, and all these cherries like swoosh into the frame and float around, and they formed a, what did they form, Nick?
Was it a bottle maybe?
They formed something. And all these cherries swarm in, they form something, and then they form the 7-Up logo and maybe the word cherry or something like that. And then they all kind of fly away. Now, when I saw it at the time, I was using 3ds Max. And when I saw the spot, I was impressed by the spot. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. It's like, is that Houdini? Like, that looks crazy because none of the cherries like penetrated each other. They were all like swarming around each other. There was dynamics going on. And in where I came from in 3ds Max Maya, like that looked really complicated and cool and just kind of like, whoa, that was neat. And then you came out with a tutorial, which was pretty short thereafter, on how to do it in Cinema 4D using MoGraph. And I was just like, I was angry. I was jealous. I was immediately just like, what? Like, how? Wait, like, this is possible? Like, I kind of went through all these different like emotions, because right around that time I was asked to do something very, very similar for a client, and I had to use 3ds Max, and oh my god, it was the biggest pain in the ass I can remember. Almost one of the hardest things to do in 3ds Max at that time. Now it's a little bit simpler, but at that time that was very difficult to do, to have something come in, hit a goal, and you know, have dynamics and then hit another goal. That was very hard to do. And so when you came out with that tutorial, I watched that thing like maybe 10 or 15 times, like just like trying to think of ways that I hadn't thought of to like get that same thing to happen. And I remember saying to guys on the team, I'm like, can you believe this? Like, look, he's making it look like it's nothing, like it's easy, and it's not. And that was like kind of a eye opener for me, I guess, in terms of like what was possible with MoGraph. And that's when I started to pay a little bit more attention to what you guys were doing, and trying to take that knowledge that you guys were putting out and saying to myself, could I do that in 3DS? Like, how would I do that in 3DS? And then it became kind of like this challenge in my head. Like, I bet Max could do that, and here's how I would approach it. And it was never easy. It was never as fast, as simple as it was in Cinema. But yeah, that tutorial stands out for me.
Dude, that was a classic. That was a really fun one to do too.
Isn't that one of the earliest cinema tutorials you have in there?
Yeah. Yeah. That might be maybe, one of the first 10, maybe. I think I did the bevel one. I did the bevel type, kind of just talking about the type tools. I think I did stuff like the subpoly displacement and the tracer and like just little tool things early on. I did a lot of early on like lighting stuff. And that was one of the big first full project ones though, for sure.
That's and those same tools that you're talking about that you were talking about in that one, Chad, is like when I'm like presenting at the Maxon booth and I'm in the back and somebody wanders over and they're like, oh, I'm from Maya or I'm from 3D Studio Max. That's always like my go-to. It's like, oh, let's clone a cube onto a sphere and then modify that and then have it transition to another thing. Because it's always like, oh, wow, you've got like three objects in the scene and you've got so much control, so much motion. Like, so people immediately, the gears start turning of like, oh, I can do so many things. Like this becomes a part of that, which feeds into this. And it just goes and goes and goes. And then you throw a dynamics tag on there and it's just like, whoa.
I think you hit the nail on the head. So the dynamics tag in and of itself is like, okay, that's not that hard. Like I get that. I think the big differentiating factor for someone who's coming from like a Maya Max background is that follow position, follow rotation doesn't exist in, to a certain degree, I had to fake it in the project that I was doing. Which basically was the way that I did it was I birthed particles on the object that I was trying to form. Okay. And then I recorded every particle's position at that state and then basically blew them all out into random places. And then I told them, okay, now go back and try to get to your original position that I recorded you at. And then they would all try to like get back to their original position and they would do that sort of thing that MoGraph with Dynamics does. Because when I first opened Cinema, that was probably the first thing that I did was try to like basically emulate your Cherry 7-Up thing. And when I turned on the file position and they all just kind of like organically like tried to get back to where they were, I was like, oh my God, dude, this is like so easy. And it's like so... Oh my God. I was like, my head started spinning. Like why doesn't this exist in every other app? Like if you want to blow a Maya person away or a Max person away, that is the best way. And if you show them that, they'll be like, what? And then if you show them, like what I discovered were all the workflow stuff that I didn't even think existed in Cinema, because I was just like, oh, that's a hobbyist tool. It doesn't have project management, tool sets. And once I dove in, I was like, oh yeah, it does. It's got layering, it's got takes, it's got object selection, selection objects, it's got everything you would want in a project management's point of view. It's just that nobody really talks about those parts of it, I don't think. So yeah,
they're not sexy to talk about.
They are to me, damn it. There are to people out there that have to like try to make money with this stuff and like produce crazy jobs on tight deadlines. Anyway, so who hasn't gone yet?
I don't think Nick has.
Oh, there you go.
I have to pick a favorite. I think anything early on was just fun for me, not only to make, but also to share and just to see other people approach it. Because I didn't have that baggage, Chad, of like knowing how hard it was. I knew that other interfaces were like, they didn't speak to me and they seemed more technical and they were more for like technical people. And so I mean, originally Cinema pulled me into it because of the interface. It didn't have dynamics. It didn't have any of that stuff when I started. It didn't have good dynamics when I started. And so what did they first call it? Mo Dynamics? When Mo Dynamics came out and I made that video of like 40,000 clones all falling on the ground, like just towers of cubes. And I rendered that out on my like G5 at work, whatever, and put it out and was like, this is now possible. And people were like as impressed as I was, and they're like, that is actually really cool. And so dynamics was the thing for me that just took my life over of like, how far can we push all that? So I'm thinking early on, like Cherry 7-Up, those kind of like or even just experimenting with dynamics in general. I made a bunch of marble machines which never really were tutorials, but it was just an experiment for me to go, you know, build my own Rube Goldberg machine in 3D. And those things were always so much fun to like figure out the how to set up the screw and like to bring it back to what we talked about a minute ago about using real life in 3D. I looked and tried to figure out how those perpetual motion Rube Goldberg style machines actually worked. And I went and rebuilt them. So for example, there was one that I always remember from my childhood of like penguins going up a set of stairs.
Oh yeah.
And they get to the top and they do a little spiral-esque curve down to the bottom. And then again, they go hop up. And the way that those little steps were built were just these two alternating, like slightly sloped steps that pushed one of the, you know, penguins up by the side little pins. And then it would fall on top of the next step and it would slide down and then it would just push and push and push. That was the mechanism. So I built that. I just built that mechanism in Cinema and then dumped a bunch of marbles into the machine and waited. And I was like, okay, cool. They're all making it up to the top and made a ladder. So then I made the little S curve or I think I made a little spiral thing that came down like those coin things at the mall. You know, you put like a quarter in them and they spin around it. So again, I looked up the curve angle of those machines and built that same curve angle in Cinema. And just like in the real world, they spun around much longer than if I just made a random curve myself. Like I used the actual curve that like lets things fall naturally. Those projects for me were my favorite. So doing them and then sharing everything is like the most exciting part of it for me was just those days of playing with Cinema for like 13 hours, making something that I thought looked slightly cool. And then brainstorming that tutorial for the next day was just some of the most like fun moments in my career for sure. So I don't know if I have a favorite. Cherry 7-Up definitely stands out. Chris, the one we made, where we went out and we not only took photos, but also 360 lighting to make a camera projection tutorial.
Oh yeah. Your garage door tutorial.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We went in industrial Chicago and shot like some garage doors and then we rebuilt the scene in 3D and then projected.
I remember sitting behind you trying to teach you some modeling tools.
Oh yeah. No,
you can extrude an edge. No, edge mode. No.
It was great because all I really needed was some basic 3D to project. Like, you know, it doesn't take a lot of 3D to add projection to really sell that effect. But I just needed a couple walls. But Chris showed me a lot of like not only projection, but also how to stick a projection when the garage door opened. So, yeah, I mean, I learned a ton there. And then, of course, when the garage doors open, I had to add dynamics, had to add some spheres.
Now I remember that one. Is that the one where all the balls come pouring out?
Yeah, the garage doors open and then all the balls come falling onto the ground. And so that was fun to me because I learned a lot from Chris on that one. And we got to get out of the office and go shoot like in the middle of summer in Chicago. So that's pretty fun.
That's always good.
Well, it was fun because we had to go around and you wanted to make it a tutorial. So we had to scout a location that had a lot of kind of 90 degree angles, like no curved surfaces and everything. So it could be a very simple, clean tutorial. And that garage environment was great. I think there's like the ramp. There's only one angle and everything else was 90 degrees.
Yeah, it was the ramp was where the shipping, I think it was where the trucks pulled in backwards, where it angled down and then the trucks would be flat and then all the garage doors would open. So it was perfect.
Well, Dynamics reminds me of, I think I went to, before I even was into Cinema 4D, I would go to the some of the meetups that were in Chicago, you know, and I don't remember what it was. It might have even been an early Half-Res where Chris had built like some sort of robot fighting arena. Oh, yeah. Did that happen? I'm not just imagining that, right? Like that actually happened, right? And the idea behind what he built was so fundamentally different than I had ever thought about Dynamics before, because in the world of Maya and Max, Dynamics are very much like, you know, you build something and you let it fall, you let it crash, you give it momentum, you give it, you know, a predetermined velocity and you let it go and you're hands off, right? And in Cinema, it was interesting to me the fact that things could have, I guess the best way to put it, and Chris jump in, but it's like having that kinetic energy built into something. So you could create a spinning, you could animate like a spinning, I don't know, like a cog or something, and then make it dynamic, and it's going to spin and like roll itself down, you know, as far as it wants to go. And that idea of giving something kinetic energy built into it is like fundamentally different from how dynamics work in 3ds Max. You can't do that. Like there's no, you can't give something energy, whether it's like if you right now, if you animated something in Cinema, like if you're trying to do like a robot, like 2 feet walking like this. Okay. And if you did that in Cinema and you made that dynamic, it would actually start to walk.
I literally have a tutorial on the website that does that.
So there you go. So that idea, I just want, you know, everybody listening to know that that idea just does not exist in 3ds Max. And if I'm wrong, feel free to hit me in the comments. But I don't think it even exists in Maya. Again, if I'm wrong, hit me in the comments. But I never found a way to use that kinetic animation to drive dynamics like that. To me, when I saw that, I think I was actually there with some other people from my team, other 3ds Max and former Maya people, and we were just like picking up our jaws off the ground like, oh my god, what? Like it was like mind-boggling to see that.
I'm thinking about your cars too, Chris. You had those cars that like as they got hit, they lost like battle damage points, and then stuff would fall off of them. Like the wheels had a certain amount of hit points, and those were actually frictioned wheels that moved around. And then as soon as they got hit enough, they would fall off.
Yeah. So just building motors and some basic intelligence into dynamics, like with Expresso. But even that, like, I mean, building hinges and then building motors that can drive things, and then using a little bit of Expresso, be like, oh, I haven't moved very far in the last second, invert this number. And then suddenly it reverses. So a little bit of intelligence goes a long way in some of those simulations.
Yeah, I think it was like that one. And then one time we all went and like you had built a game or something. Like it might be the game that we did at the last one where all of the things try to jump into something. And I remember looking at that going, okay, you know what? I think I may have underestimated Cinema 4D if this is possible. Because I just have never seen anything like that before.
Yeah. Well, it's always my goal to make absurd things whenever possible. Where it's like, why do we need intelligent driving cars like that know when the reverse and the backup? It's like, I don't know. Like, we'll build into a game at half res and everybody can cheer them on. because you can't use that for a client.
No, I mean, well, you could maybe if you're trying to like simulate a car accident, maybe, I don't know, but yeah, it's not about that. It's just about the possibility of that. Exactly. You know, like that to me is like, when I saw that, I was like, whoa, okay. So it's not just a bunch of like, MoGraph, you know, stuff. It's actually, there's some meat there where you could actually set up a system with intelligence. Like that to me was like a little bit like, oh, I'm going to start watching this program.
So I'm dropping a lot of links here in the show notes. And that reminds me, I think at the beginning we said it was 48, but it looks like, or 49, but it looks like we're on episode 48 for those of you listening. If you want to come back and link up to any of this stuff, anything we talk about, we're trying to take notes here on YouTube, if you're watching, and also don't forget on our blog. And if you're listening on iTunes, you should be able to see these links there as well. Just want to let everybody know 48. Getting up there. What do we do? What's 50th anniversary? Is that the 3D anniversary? There's paper, there's metal, and then there's 3D in there somewhere.
I think it's the whiskey one. I think.
Oh,
maybe
we should live cast that one.
Live cast the 50th. There you go. Yeah. That makes it special.
Then it means, you know, people can heckle us.
yell about my coffee drinking.
Well, what else do we have?
You have a big thing.
Have a big thing, and it's something that I'm going to try my hardest to be politically correct. I guess
objective.
Yeah, that's the word. Although it's hard to be objective, I guess, but because I've got strong feelings, and whenever strong feelings are involved, you know, in this day and age, it's a lot of
strong feelings equals facts, right?
Yeah, you got it, man.
Nailed it.
You nailed it. Good. So I got news from the rendering, the render war front line.
Oh yeah. What's going on in the render?
In the render wars, we've got, I'm going to do that voice and just annoy the shit out of
old timey, like 20s voice.
In a stunning revolution of rendering technology. So this is what happened, over the last week. Someone pointed out to me, a buddy of mine who has been on the show. I will not say his name just in case this goes south. I don't want him pulled into anything. Notified me that Solid Angle took the node locked license off of their site and only are started selling floating licenses. Now, you're probably saying, if you don't own this and you've never seen it before, you're probably like, what the hell is the difference between a node lock license and a floating license? Well, typically, node lock licenses are cheaper because you're not putting them on a bunch of different machines. You're not floating them around to, let's say, you know, your machine, your neighbor's machine, yada, yada. Studios tend to use more of the floating license and not so much of the node lock licenses. So node lock licenses tend to be cheaper. They tend to be more affordable for the average user. So he pointed out to me that the node lock license was removed from their site. Therefore, if you want to purchase Arnold right now, it is going to cost you $1,220 as of the date of this podcast, which is January 30th, 2017. And I think that was a very interesting and I'm just going to throw a little editorial voice, disappointing move, because that to me is really, really expensive, given that, yes, it is an amazing renderer and fantastic tool set, but is it worth $1,220 plus every year paying a $225 a year maintenance fee to stay current on said software? That on top of the fact that Arnold is a CPU renderer, meaning that if you want to render on, let's say, more than one machine, you're going to need a farm or some other machines laying around, like we just did a tutorial on Team Render. And you'll have to pay that $1,220 for every other machine that you own. So that happened. And then shortly thereafter, people noticed that Rebus Farms, one of the most popular cloud-based rendering solutions, dropped Arnold from their supported renderer list. Coincidence? I don't know. All I will say is that a lot of people were upset and complained because, you know, they plan for this. So they have a job, let's say they want to use this on, and you know, they're ready to rock, and all of a sudden it's unsupported. They don't have anywhere else to go, or seemingly maybe they don't know of any other place to go, Pixel Plow. And you have to, you know, it interrupts your workflow. It's very nerve-wracking. So people are upset about that. Eventually, they came back and said, we're going to honor anybody that had render credits for using Arnold. We're going to honor them for a certain amount of time. And in addition to that, they're going to support Arnold for, I think, another couple weeks or something. So they didn't just, I think they realized that they literally had just pulled the rug out from a few people mid project. And that's not cool to do to anybody. This whole thing sparked a lot of controversy, I guess, in the small community of Arnold, Cinema 4D Arnold users, because everybody's got the Autodesk fear, which is real. Not going to lie, been through it. Soft homage. So it started this whole thing where it's like, $1,220. Like, that is a lot of money. That's a lot of cash to throw down, especially when there's all sorts of other renderers out there. So I'm waiting. I threw a line out to them saying, I'd really like to know, is there going to be an affordable solution for independent artists or small studios? Or is this going to be the new permanent price license structure? They have not gotten back to me yet. I hope to hear back because I do still think it's a great tool. I just personally think that that amount of money is going to price many people, including myself. I would not pay that much money.
Was it under it was under 1,000 before, right?
Yes. So let me break this down. So under when you were buying a node lock license, it depends on when you bought it because the price fluctuated. You could have paid anywhere from $500 to $790 depending on who or where, when and where you bought it from. You bought it from them, but depending on your deal. So if you're going from a node lock license today and you wanted to buy tomorrow, let's say a new license, you're going to see a 64% increase in price. In addition to that, if you bought a floating license, like let's say 3 months ago, and you were to buy one today, they raised the price on the floating license as well. As far as I know, hit me in the comments if I'm wrong about this. Glad to correct it. But it's you're seeing an 11% increase in the floating license cost. So not only did node license artists take a hit, but so did studios that were buying floating licenses. They saw an 11% increase. And I just am wondering what the motivation was, what the deal was. I mean, we know that software companies need to make a certain amount of money to stay viable, us being one. But at the same time, I think we have a level of transparency with our customers that we're able to explain our decisions in a way that makes sense and hopefully instills confidence. Whereas I feel a little like, you know, this decision happened and somebody just noticed it and it just became kind of a little bit viral in some places. So it was a little bit concerning because as one of the people at GSG that uses Arnold a lot and teaches it a lot, I want to know what's going to happen with it because I want to know for both our users, our customers, our scene that if it's going to continue to be a really super high-end price, then that tells me where it fits into the market. And so I'm just waiting to hear back and see what happens, but it's a bit frustrating to be honest.
Yeah. I always assume there's some sort of good reason that they do this kind of stuff. Like you said, we run a software company and you have to stay viable. You have to make sure you're doing the right stuff for your customers, for yourself to stay in business so that you can continue to take care of customers. But it'll be interesting to hear from them what, you know, why they did that. Is there a guess? Is there a, you know,
I could speculate, but I know all these people and I don't want to start rumors or anything like that. I think that whatever the decision was.
Well, and this just happened too, right?
Yeah, it literally just happened at the end of last week.
Yeah, so we'll get some more news as the week rolls on, and I'm sure we'll revisit that. But you know, in general, though, it reminds me of a trend that's happening anyway, which is the high end of the market is like going higher and higher, and the lower end of the market is almost sometimes like left to figure this stuff out. You know, there's super high budget jobs. There's giant productions, and then there's all this other stuff that kind of floats around, and freelancers and one-offs, and sometimes, you know, now there's a template world of like, and now I could just use a template to do this, and there's this lower end stuff that used to, I don't know, let me get my thoughts together on this, but there's something going on right now where there's a lot more the middle of the market is getting interesting right now.
Well, the middle is just dropping out if you think about it. I mean, I don't know if I would go as far as to say like, you know, the high end is doing like this crazy amazing work. I think that they're able, you know, to do it at a higher capacity given their resources and the team size and all that sort of thing.
I certainly don't want to say it's higher end or lower end the actual work that comes out of it, because I think that's what's powerful right now is the ability to look at something and not know if it came from a giant render farm in California or somebody's bedroom in Wisconsin. Like that's the whole point of this stuff. So it's not about the quality, but I guess what I mean is higher end budgets is there's the ability to pay these prices that you just mentioned. And then there's the ability to not necessarily be able to afford that. So how people, the software gap between those two things and what you can use is not just available for everybody. It's going to go almost back to old school 3D land where, you know, what, you know, when it was $10,000 for just for a license back in the day. So
Let's hope not, man. Like, yeah. I think that you do. That's a good point. The idea of being able to do more with less is a trend, and that we saw that trend kind of take form in the GPU kind of rendering revolution, I guess you could call it, with Octane, and people started realizing that they could get results, very amazing, excellent results with a fairly minimal impact in terms of money. And so you look at something like Octane, which I believe costs about to get the Octane standalone plugin and the Cinema 4D plugin, I want to say it's close to $800, and I should have known this price before I even said that, so if I'm probably wrong. But you know, you got that opposed to the $1,220 that Arnold is asking, and you got to say to yourself, okay, well, what's the differentiating factor? What am I going to get out of one that I can't get out of the other? And yeah, I could go on and talk about those features, but at some point you have to, as an artist or a small studio, put an actual value against those features to see whether or not it's something you should invest in. Like to me, it was a lot easier to push people towards Arnold when the feature set was so rich, and yeah, it was maybe 10, 15, even 20% more expensive than the average renderer at the time. But those features, in my opinion, made up for that. And when you have such a high price of entry for it now, I would have a very difficult time saying to anybody that these features are worth that extra money, given that with a little bit more elbow grease and time, you could achieve the same effects given just about any other renderer. Especially ones that run on GPU, because you know you're going to get more bang for your buck in terms of if you have a GPU system with multiple GPUs, like you're already way ahead of the game in terms of people that are operating on CPU only, which can be a drag. So I don't know. I mean, maybe we just play the wait and see. And I thought about it and I'm like, well, you know, is this a reaction to the possibility of a future of an Arnold GPU? And if, you know, I don't have any data to back this up. This is only my opinion. And only, so I want to preface this with, this is just my opinion, my concept. Don't blame me if this is not at all what happened. But think about if you're a CPU renderer and you're charging per machine, okay, and that's your business model. And all of a sudden, you know, you start looking at the GPU and you used to charge per machine and someone to do, you know, the jobs that we kind of talk about and do, you would need more than one machine to render on. It's just you can't render on CPU on one machine. That's going to just take forever. So you have a small farm, or maybe you have three or four extra machines, and you're buying licenses for those machines because each machine is a license. So that business model of selling licenses per machine makes sense. Okay. So when you start thinking about the world in a GPU scenario, suddenly you have less machines. Suddenly you have one machine. Suddenly you have studios that used to have 50 nodes are now doing everything on three GPU decked out machines. So the amount of licenses you sell is less. Mm-hmm. Yet the development cost is probably more. So maybe that's the reason. Maybe this is just all front loading for the GPU renderer. I don't know. Speculation. Don't have any inside information. Just one man's opinion. But it is interesting, though, if you think about that and think about what that means to a company that developed for multiple computers in a world that's kind of going to less computers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's something I haven't really thought about until you just said that. Like, if you have a business model built around, yeah, a farm that everybody needed, and especially a place to do high-end work, everybody needed one. And now it's, right, you're right. You could do not only more with less, but you could also plug in a bunch of video cards into one machine and technically be on the same license. So, yeah, interesting stuff, man. That's... that we're going to see how that goes. And I know it's got to be expensive to develop, keep up with a professional renderer. So I'm sure they need the money to keep this stuff looking good and making sure it's there. But that'll be interesting as we figure this stuff out. Chad, We need to get you and now with the render, now with the render war news, like intro. Chris, you got a good voice for that. Do you have like a good intro for Chad for Render Wars?
Oh no, we'd have to think about that. Do that off camera.
We're not gonna brainstorm this right now.
I have fun nerding out on this stuff, and I always like, you know, seeing where it's all headed. And my latest obsession right now is Redshift, and I've been having a lot of fun on the Redshift alpha. And it's just cool to see all these different interesting things pop up and try to figure them out.
You know, a lot of people have been asking too about Redshift and HDRI Link. And I know we can't put any videos out right now because it's an alpha, but I just did want to try to get it out while we have some people around hanging out. If you are looking at HDRI Link, or a friend is, or if you could help us answer these questions too, it is working with Redshift, right, Chad?
Yep.
But we can't necessarily show that in use because it's not out for public use, right? It's part of the NDA or whatever, you know, Chad's a part of to beta test and alpha test this stuff. So if you're looking at, you know, Redshift and that and adding that to your workflow in the near future, know that it looks like HDRI Link will be compatible. So that's good news.
Actually, if you're on the alpha, because it was an open alpha, I think it might not be open anymore. But if you're on the alpha, you already can look at a video that I made that shows you how to use HDRI Link with it. You just have to sign into the alpha forum and search for it in there. And it'll show you how to get up and running with HDRI Link.
Dude, sweet. I didn't even know that. Thanks for making that.
Yep.
You the man. Well, anything else before we jump into all the fun stuff we're working on this week?
I think we covered it.
Yeah.
We did it. I got to show you this thing. I'm so obsessed with this thing now. So part of this event I went to was sponsored by Inventables, which is a Chicago company. They make a lot of 3D machines, stuff to do 3D printing and materials, and they do a lot of that kind of maker stuff. And they brought all the machines to make this, which they call a fidget spinner. And if you're anything like me, you are not only air drumming, you're table drumming, you're shaking your legs while watching movies, and just in general, fidgeting around. And now there's this whole movement of like fidget fixing. Have you guys seen these little cubes that you can get, and they just have little pen clickers at the top and a little safe dial on the other side and one of those little thumb safe dials? And
it's like a schizophrenic like door clicker thing.
Yeah, yeah. You just hold it in your hand, you click, and you could spin knobs and all that stuff. So I saw these, and if you're listening to this, basically what this is a little flat piece of, you can make them out of wood or plastic, and there's ball bearings in it. And you could just put your finger on it, do a little spin. You got the edges here to play with. And they're just really fun. And for those of you who have a problem like I do, you don't need to call it a problem. But
what problem is this?
I don't know where this comes from for me. I think I think better when I'm kind of moving. I think that's just a part of my personality, is like, I can't sit and just think about something. I have to, if I'm talking, I'm moving, or I'm sketching, or you guys know, if I'm trying to explain something, sometimes I'm just sketching and drawing, not to make it make more sense for you, because it's probably, if you look at my drawing, making less sense. But in some ways, just the movement of my hand is making it more clear in my head, maybe because I think more visually or something. I don't know what the internal kind of conflict is there. But this thing was just really fun. I think you could actually go to their site and get these things, or if you have a 3D printer or access to it, it's just kind of a fun little thing. I didn't think that something as simple as like, what do we do and fidget with, could be just solved with like 3D printing technology, but I think it's just so interesting that like it's almost a problem that was fixed by like pen tips for years, you know, like, and now they're like, wow, we could actually build these little fidget robots. So I don't know. It's just kind of, I'm obsessed with this concept and it is now a part of my pocket. It is now in there for when I'm waiting in line.
Is it part of your EDC now?
It's part of my EDC. Dude, I got to take one of those photos and pull it out, get my field notes.
Everybody's going to be totally confused by what that thing is. They're going to be like, what is that?
My wallet.
It's like brass knuckles.
Actually, when they came out, mine are pretty tight in there. I kind of have to hammer the ball bearings in there. But some of them came out over the course of the weekend and people were walking around with them like brass knuckles, actually. It was pretty helpful. Keep safe at the at Google. Cool. Well, any other announcements, anything else? Keep the topic ideas coming, guys, too. We're just gonna talk about what's topical, what's news, what's going on. But if you guys are struggling with anything out there, have a specific question that is not necessarily a Cinema 4D question, where we don't really hop on and show you the interface on these things. But if you guys have any questions about what's happening with you, your career, or how this market's going in general, we'd love to be able to help or even discuss it. We obviously don't have all the answers, but we love talking about this stuff and would like to help. So thank you as always, Chad. I'll you introed this. I'm going to let you do the outro.
I'll take us out.
Oh, this is good.
Thank you very much, Nick. No, I was going to do my old-timey radio voice there, but it wasn't really working out. Anyway, well, yes, thanks again, everyone, for listening. And check us out next time. Every week we try to do one of these. And feel free to hit the old like button and subscribe if you're on YouTube. Always check us out in our other areas. We are now, I think, iTunes, Android, RSS, anywhere where you listen to a podcast, and tell your friends that we are around and are willing to sit there and talk to them while they do something boring over the weekend. So with that, I'll bid you adieu. Thank you, Nick Campbell.
Thanks, Chad.
Thank you, Chris Schmidt.
Thanks, everybody.
And we shall see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye-bye.